From Sounds True, Dr. Quantum presents A User's Guide to Your Universe, Session 11, Time Traveling Through the Universe with Fred Allen Wolf.
We're now going to begin session 11, and this is a little bit of a twist. I've taken you from the beginnings of quantum physics and the ideas of quantum physics into the mystical and the new alchemical, and now we're moving into something which is really a merger of the two, but it's going to sound a little strange. It's called time traveling through the universe. Can we time travel? Is it possible to really time travel? And if you want, we can look at this as a yoga for time travel, or a way to use your mind to defeat time. The ancients called it Kala Vankara, which means cheating time. Whoa, these guys were concerned with how it was we could get around the problems we all face called getting older, getting more feeble, getting old and dying. Can we escape time itself? Well, that's really what this is all about, a yoga for time travel, or how we can use our minds to actually travel in time. So in order to explain this to you, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about what time travel is itself all about. So first of all, let me begin with some nonsense. I mean, some of you think this may be nonsense anyway, so let's talk this way. "I don't understand you," said Alice. "It's dreadfully confusing."
"That's the effect of living backwards," says the Red Queen,
rather kindly.
"It always makes one a little giddy at first."
"Living backwards," Alice replied in a great astonishment. I never heard of such a thing as that."
"But," the Queen replied, "there's one great advantage in it, that one's memory works both ways."
"Huh?" says Alice. "I'm sure mine only works one way. I can't remember things before they happen,"
the Queen remarks. "It's only a poor sort of memory that works backwards only," the Queen says.
What is this all about? This, of course, is Charles Dodson's, Lewis Carroll's, delightful Through the Looking Glass, The Adventures of Alice in Wonderland. Dodson, or Lewis Carroll, was very much into the notions of the logical problems that result when we begin to think about looking at time in a backwards going sense rather than in a forwards going sense. Most of us would think that it's utterly nonsense to even conceive of the mind going backwards through time. In other words, the future is being remembered now. How can we do that? The future hasn't happened yet, like Alice said. But if we begin to really look at time from a new perspective, that is the perspective we can get from looking at two different views which are separated by maybe 3,000, 4,000 years of time, we will emerge with a view which says not only is it possible, it's inevitable that we will be able to travel through time to be able to experience the future coming into the present and influencing us in such a way that it won't drive us up the wall and drive us into the arms of the nearest skeptic who says, "This is all purely nutty, crazy kind of talk. that nothing like this could ever really happen. So in order to understand all that, we need to talk about time and what time is. Okay, let's look at time. There wasn't a saint, Saint Augustine, who lived in the late 4th and early 5th centuries, and he wrote about time. He said this, "What then is time? If no one asks me, I know what it is. But if I wish to explain it to him who asks me, I do not know what to say." Perhaps Augustine was referring to how difficult it is to reconcile our common subjective sense of time with the words that we speak to describe that common subjective sense of time. We all have a subjective sense of time, at least we think we do, but to actually describe it in words, to tell somebody else what that is without them already knowing what we're going to say, that's a horse of a different color. Augustine, who lived in the town of Hippo, was quite a wise guy, but did he really know what to say? I mean, he claims he didn't, but did he know? Did he actually know why this was so difficult? He went on to say that, "I can say with confidence that I know that if nothing passed away, there would be no past." Oh, okay, I got that, Saint. I got that. "And if nothing were still coming, there would be no future. And if there were nothing at all, then there would be no present." I got it. So if nothing passes, there's no past. If nothing's coming, there is no future. And if nothing's there, there is no there. Okay, well, that seems like, duh, what's that all about? So in other words, the idea of passing away and coming in and being there all seem to be pointing to what we mean by the nature of time itself. That which is yet to come, that which has already been here, and that which is here right now. But when we get to the physics of all that, in fact, even when we get to our experience of all that, we find ourselves in a tremendous amount of quandary. Let me tell you why. First of all, let's talk about passing away. Is what's passed away there? Well, we might scratch our heads and say, no. Is what's coming there? We might scratch our heads and say, no. Is what's there? And when there, we might start smiling and say, oh, yeah. Wait a minute. How do we know there's there? How do we know that thing out there is really out there? How do we know? Well, we can touch it. We can smell it. We can taste it. We can feel it. Da-da-da. Our senses tell us that. But think about this. In order for you to sense an object that is out there with your fingers touch it. Electromagnetic signals go up into the neurons which connect up into your arm, into your sensing, so that you have neuronal signals going up into your arm, into your spinal column, in your spinal column, up into your cerebellum, in your cerebellum, into your brain, into your cortical regions of your brain, your somatosensory cortical regions of the brain, into the frontal regions of the brain where you interpret what's going on. And then once you say, ah, that's a glass of cold mush, then that sensation, those thoughts go all the way back down from your interpretive cortex into your somatosensory cortex, all the way back down into your cerebellum, back into your spinal column, and then back out to your arm, so that when you're feeling it, you're saying, ah, mushy, mushy, mushy. That all takes time, Matilda. Because it takes time, are you really sensing what's out there now? No, you can't sense what's now because you're integrating a whole bunch of experiences. And in that integration, you say, that's my now. But there is no now. There is the past, the future, all together now. And that's what you call now. It's not just now. What's now would be at this very instant. It's the nanosecond, the billionth part of a billionth part of a billionth part of a billionth part of a second, and that is so small that nobody ever experiences that. So what do we mean by now? What can be now? What is there about now? If we realize and are fully willing to accept that it is impossible to know now at all, then what you call now is really a window of time that extends into the past and into the future now. So that your now is an integration of all that experiences. There is no such thing happening now. In other words, there is no now now, and that means there is no such thing as an object out there now. It doesn't exist that way. In order for something to exist, it has to exist over a window of time. And that's just trying to make sense of all this. And what's the problem with all that? What's the problem? The problem is that we have linearized time. We've made it into a straight line, and we believe that there's a before, a middle, and an end. We have all of that in our minds. And when we try to lay out our experiences on that straight line time, we run into these kind of troubles, these kinds of problems, these kinds of confusions in our thought. So maybe the Red Queen isn't so nutty after all when she says it's a poor mind that only can think one way in time. Because actually, your memory may not be what you think it is after all. It may not just be what happened in the past. It may be a little bit of what's in the future mixing into what happened in the past. And that is your time window. So even what you think is now is not really what you think it is. Okay, that's neurophysiology, and that's physics, and that's time, as we think about it now. There was a time when a book that was written in India called the Bhagavad Gita, which appeared, in which these kinds of ideas were also in the minds of the people that wrote the Gita. And, for example, there's a story. It's a wonderful story, and I recommend that everybody read it. It's the story in the Gita, of Arjuna and his charioteer driver, whose name happens to be Krishna. Now, you may get a little, weird or feeling, oh, I know what the story is about, Krishna, the god of time, the great god, blah, blah, blah. But here's what I want you to think about. You see, I take cabs every once in a while. So do you. You get in a cab once in a while, right? And, especially in New York City, I hop in a cab. I look to see who's the driver of the cab. And invariably, I find that the driver's name is like Moses or Jesus. Many times I get a cab driver whose name is Moses or a cab driver whose name is Jesus. And that ain't Moses driving the cab, the Moses of the Bible. And that ain't Jesus of the Bible driving the cab. I kind of know that. So it shouldn't be too surprising to you that in ancient times there would be a charioteer driver whose name is Krishna. After all, Moses, Jesus, Krishna, whatever it is. Okay, so this story deals with Arjuna, who's a king, who has to go to battle. And he has to go to battle with a bunch of guys who happen to be old friends, old relationships, cousins, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, relations of his, people that he once loved, maybe still does, who are now on the other side of this battle, this war, whatever they're fighting for, a new land, the rights to this, the charioteers who want their horses to be taken care of 15 hours a day instead of 20 hours. God knows what they're fighting about. They're going into war. And war is a pretty awful thing to have to deal with. And the Gita is a story that takes us right into the heart of this warfare that's going on. And Arjuna, knowing he's got to fight these people, is upset. He's really upset. He doesn't want to fight these people. So he decides to have a conversation, as you might do, with his charioteer, his driver, because his driver is the furthest from his immediate familial surroundings. Krishna, his driver. So he says, Krishna, he says, I'm really worried about all this. I don't really want to do all this fighting and killing and all this kind of stuff. What do you think I should do? And then Krishna turns around to him and says, I am time, the great destroyer of the worlds. Even without you, will all the people here, all the fighters here, on both sides of this war, all of them, be engaged in destroying. All of them will be dead. Oh, who is this uppity Krishna talking to me like that? I'm the king. He dares to address me in such a voice? Who do you think you are, Mr. Krishna? He says, whoa, I'm not just your charioteer driver, Krishna, somebody. I am the Krishna. I'm the guy. I'm the great Lord God of all. I am the God of time. You see, what the Gita is telling us is something about another way of looking at reality. I'll get back to our story in just a minute. Let me just tell you about this other way in the Gita. It says that behind everything, regardless of how horrible it is, how wonderful it is, how wonderful it smells, how stinky it smells, how beautiful it is, how ugly it is, how much killing there is going on, how much loving there is going on, behind all of that drama and trauma, and we love drama, and even though we don't like necessarily have trauma, trauma is a part of our lives, our everyday lives, particularly in the West. Behind all that changing reality, there is an infinite unchanging reality, and it exists behind all of that illusion of change. More, this reality, this unchanging, this infinite, this thing which exists beyond everything is at the core of your being. It is at the core of you. In fact, it is you. You are that. And it is the substratum of your whole personality. You're not who you think you are. You're not what you think you are. You're not even how you think you are. You are that which can even conceive of how, what, and where, and who you think you are. Thirdly, your life has one purpose, one major, you know, biggie, one purpose, and that is to experience this reality, this unchanging reality, this whole reality, to discover it, to get into it, to be part of it while you are here living on Earth playing your snotty games. Oh my goodness, can I do that? We may ask ourselves. And what I'm telling you is, yeah, every one of us can do it. And when you do it, life becomes a whole different kettle of fish. It becomes a magical light show. It becomes more fun. And not only can you have more fun, you can be even time traveling through the universe. So why not? Who wants to not have more fun in life? Who wants to just see life as a continuing movie show? We all like to go to movies. We love our movies. We love our television sets. Do you know, this is going to maybe make some of you a little nuts. Did you know that they found out that people that watch television are happier than people that don't? People that engage in all this fantasy, we always think, well, why don't you get a life? You know, actually, they have a life. And they actually have more fun and find life more interesting because they watch television. It used to be, well, I was taught when growing up, when television first came about, they said, if you watch too much television, it makes mush of your brains. Well, maybe it's good to have a mushy brain. It might make you a better human being. Why is that going? What is happening there? Because it is telling you something about the illusion of reality. By letting you watch the illusion of reality called TV, you actually are tuning into the bigger TV, the big TV in the sky, the holographic world we call this our everyday universe. Anyway, that's just an aside. Let's go back to Arjuna and our story here. Krishna tells Arjuna that he is the beginning and the ending of all things. He is the source and the final outcome of all things. He is the eternal one. He's the guy that's there when everything else appears and then disappears. He's the guy that's always there. He's the there-ness that is always there, the there that's beyond space and time. And Krishna, seeing how despondent Arjuna is, says, look, I'm going to do you a big, big, biggie, a big favor here. I'm going to let you look into me and see who and what I actually am. I'm going to let you look into me, the God of time. You're going to see who and what I am. And then Krishna invites Arjuna to peer into his own body and to look at the hundreds and thousands and millions of his forms, including all the things which move and don't move, and whatever else that Arjuna wishes to see can be seen by looking in. This universal form, he tells Arjuna, this form can show you whatever you desire to see and whatever you may want to see in the future. Everything, moving, non-moving, is here, complete within me. Well, Arjuna is amazed, but he accepts Krishna at his wish, and he looks in. And what he sees is a sight is so bright and powerful as like looking at the rising of 100,000 suns and a single sunrise. How he can see through that is beyond my understanding, but he manages. And he sees images. He sees images of thousands upon thousands of mouths and teeth and tongues and billions upon billions of eyes and different colors and eyebrows and eyelashes and nostrils and noses and hair and different colors and arms and armpits and breasts and legs and genitalia and feet and toes and stomachs and inside of stomachs and atoms and molecules and universes and stars and the moon and the sun and on 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 and on. It goes, it goes, it goes, it goes. And then he sees the face of Krishna, not the face of Krishna, but the face of Krishna, the face of Krishna, the face of all the billions upon billions upon billions of faces that Krishna has. And what Arjuna notices is that several of those faces, a lot of those faces, a million of those faces, an infinity of those faces are nothing more than the face of Arjuna himself. That he sees that Krishna and Arjuna are the same. And then he knows. He then realizes the truth. Krishna is telling Arjuna, look, guy, all of those faces, all of those pictures, all of those things you see, these are just momentary collapses of possibilities into actualities. These are just momentary, brief moments in the whole history of the great time of which I am that take place. And that if you string them all together like this, like you see me, what you're seeing is possibilities changing into actualities, dissolving into possibilities, changing into actualities, dissolving into possibilities, changing into actualities. And if you look at all of that, you can piece together how the possibilities and actualities change into each other, change into each other, change into each other, and you can make a sequence, a line through them, and you call that sequence time, and you call that line time, and you call that birth, life, death, rebirth, life, death, rebirth, life, death, on and on. And on and on. And no matter how many thousands of times you see that, billions of times you see that, including the stars and the universe and the galaxies and all that stuff going on, in spite of how many times all that goes on, they're all you. None of them is different than you. You are that. That's what you are. All the rest is merely commentary. The commentary of the process of how you hide from yourself, of how you appear as something other than what you really are. So think about that, guys, gals. You are something beyond this whole temporal experience. Now, once you get that into your noodle, the idea of traveling through time is like nothing, because time itself is just the string you run through the beads, but the beads are all momentarily collapses of possibilities into actualities, which then relax into possibilities again. And you, no matter where you are, no matter how old you are, no matter when you're alive, no matter when you lived, no matter when you are going to live, are going to go through that same process over again. You're going to come into being as a personality, a limitation, a collapsing. You're going to then learn how to control by collapsing more so that you can get up and walk around, so that you're not just a namby-pamby, so that you're not just doing the same things over and over again. You're going to learn to master life. And then as you start to master life, you're going to find life to be a little disgusting. Nobody goes through life without finding life a little disgusting. Oh, you mean it's okay to be depressed? Yeah. Not only is it okay for you to be depressed, it's okay for you to come out of your depression too, because every one of us does that. You're not sick because you find life to be disgusting, but you are sick if that's all you do is find life to be disgusting. What you have to do is relax. Allow the disgust to come in and then let it pass, because it will pass if you simply let it pass, because you're not that. You're not the disgust. You're not what you think you are. You're not the image of who you think you are. You're not the face you see in the mirror. You're not that fat person. You're not that old person. You're not that skinny person. You're not that sexy person. You're not that beautiful person. Your hair is not long and curly. You're not a bald old slob. You're not a beautiful young slob. You're not a slob at all. You're not even a neat person at all. You're not any of that. That's just the momentary collapses of the possibilities, which give you the sense of being and presence of being in a material world. That's what you do. That's what we do. That's how we get caught in the illusion. That's how we play the game again. That's how we watch the movie. That's what we do. That's what time traveling is really all about. It's when you realize that you're not that, that you suddenly see all of time. You see everything you've been, everything you were, everything you are, and it all becomes sensible to you. Now, the way you prove this to yourself is you go out into the world and you look. And if you meditate on this, if you go into an enlightenment intensive in which you begin asking yourself, who am I? What am I? Who am I? What am I? And you begin to answer that question and get through all of the obvious answers. I am the president of a bank. I am the theoretical physicist. My name is Fred Allen Wolf. My name is Joe Blow. My name is Sam Sork. I am this. I am. When you go through all that, what I call the BSing, when you go through all of that stuff, eventually what emerges is a sense of just being. When you're in that state of consciousness, you can walk out onto the street and you will see another person's face and you will immediately see who that person was, who that person's going to be, when that person was. You can see all the lives of that person in one time. You can see it in their face. You can see their suffering. You can see their delight. You can see their femininity. You can see their masculinity. You can see all these things. When you have that kind of seeing power going with you wherever you go, you can look at animals, and you can see what animals are. You can see how they are within the confines of the temporal zone and couldn't care less about the future or the past. They're just now. They're being into whatever that now experience is without even knowing what that now experience is. You can begin to see that the dog is the dog is the dog throughout all the time, regardless of whose dog it is or when that dog was. You can begin to see how animals are what they are. You can begin to intune yourself to the world. Your psychic abilities will emerge enormously. You'll never have to go to a psychic. You just got to look at yourself in the mirror and suddenly everything will appear to you. It's like an acid trip. For those of you who have never taken acid, and for those of you that have, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's something very special that happens to you, and it all comes about by learning to do just one thing and one thing only, surrender that precious ego. Surrender your I-ness, your highness, and you become the king of all there is. Now you've heard this, and you may think, whoa, I'd like to do all that. Is there any evidence that anybody's ever done that before? For example, let's talk about the Buddha. The Buddha once said, what is all this? A phantom, a dew, a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning and a cloud. Thus we should look upon all that was ever made. The Buddha, in his meditations, was able to see all of his past incarnations, according to what his students wrote about him, anyway. So the Buddha was able to see beyond the barriers of time. Now let me just put a little bit of humor into this. Douglas Adams, the fantastic writer who wrote The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, said, time is an illusion. Lunchtime, doubly so. Just a little bit of note of fun in there. Let me go now to a more contemporary person who saw the illusion of time, was able to get beyond it. This was a master who died in 1950, so not so long ago. And he was born, his name was Venkataraman. This guy, Venkataraman, was born in a village in the south of India, and he later became very honored in India. And he also was seen by many Westerners who experienced his power. Those who later on saw him gave him a name. They called him Sri Ramana Maharshi. Sri is like our sir, in like a knightly way. It's a statement of honor, Sri Ramana Maharshi. And this guy was able to go beyond the bounds of time. And he did it in exactly the same way that I'm telling you, by giving up his ego. When he was 12 years old and his father died, he went to live with an uncle who was in the nearby city of Madurai. In 1896, at the age of 16, he left his uncle's home and he journeyed to one of South India's holy places. It was a mountain, a sacred mountain that had the name Arunachala. He had heard of this mountain briefly when he was visiting his elderly relatives, and they had told him that this was a very special place. You gotta go. Merely hearing the name Arunachala had a very magical effect on this guy. He was only a boy, but the same, he was very young. But yet, an internal kind of an excitement grew in him as a result, which he could not understand. He couldn't explain it to himself. So a few months after hearing the name, he decided to go to this place. And he had an experience which really changed his whole life. He was in his bedroom of the second floor of his uncle's house just before he left, and he was suddenly overwhelmed with something that maybe you've been overwhelmed with from time to time, the fear of death. And he became firmly convinced that he was going to die any minute now. This feeling persisted for such a time, and even though he logically knew he was healthy, he shouldn't be going through this, but he nevertheless felt this. He was shaking with fear. He began to ponder the significance of this death. What does this mean? What does it mean? Well, he was alone in a room, and he decided, I might as well just surrender to it and go through it. If that's what's going to happen. So he lay down on the floor and decided that he would act out. He would get into it. He would play the part of somebody dying. And as he did so, he would ask himself questions. In other words, while I'm dying, I'm going to find out what's happening to me while I'm dying. I'm going to ask myself questions. I'm going to go on with this intellectual processing. So he lay down, he put his arms to his sides, held his breath. He actually tried to die, held his breath, and he said to himself, now that death has come to me, what does it mean? What is dying? Is it this body that is dying? If it's dying, it's going to be carried off to the cremation ground and burned to ashes. But with the death of the body, am I going to die? Am I just my body? No, the body is growing silent and inert, but I still feel the full force of my personality, and even the voice of my eye is coming through here, this body. Does the body die? And I die with it? Or am I apart from the body? If I'm a spirit transcending the body, Then the body can die, but the spirit transcends it. It can't be touched by the death. This means that I am deathless spirit. Well, how should we look at that? I mean, as scientists, well, you know, we can. Some neurologists would say that there's a part of the brain that thinks itself to be spirit. All right, there's a part of the brain that thinks itself to be spirit. All right, well, we've located that when you're thinking of spiritual things, this part of your brain is firing. All right, all right, all right. But I ask the scientist, I ask myself as a scientist, does the fact that my brain is firing while I'm thinking spiritual things indicate that the firing is the thinking of those spiritual things? Or is that just the energy that is exposed to my eye of science when this thought is entering into the brain? And maybe the spiritual impetus for it, that which moves it, lies outside of the brain in the first place. How do we know? Anyway, this guy, whether he was under the illusion of thinking this or not, I won't even get into it with you. Let's just say he believed this and decided to act from now on as if this was the fundamental truth of his life, which is what I'm recommending you do too if you want to get into this. His self-realization was instantaneous and complete and irreversible. His ego was gone. He was lost in the flood of pure self, and I use the word self spelled with a great big S rather than with a little tiny S, awareness. Soon after this experience, he left for the mountains. When he arrived there, he left go of every single thing he had, all of his possessions, gone. He didn't care whether he lived or he died. His fingernails grew to, you know, really ugly lengths, and his hair fell out, his teeth began to fall out. He just became a mess. And people noticed him, and in India, people pay attention to that, and they don't just let it go. In America, we say, get out of here, you bum! You know, go find a shelter, you homeless slob! You know, we're in the West, we're a little bit heartless about homeless people. We don't like to look at anything which frightens us. And believe me, this would have been a frightening sight, but in India, they're a little different. They didn't throw this guy, particularly since he was in Arunachal, which is a sacred mountain, and that even said, you know, just because he looks like a bum doesn't mean he's a bum. This guy may be a real guru. He may really be an avatar. We got to pay attention to this guy. We got to really look at this. And so with that, and people coming to him, feeding him, bathing him, combing his hairs, giving him botees, little things to wear around his waist so he wasn't exposing himself to the children as they walked by, he gradually became a sacred being of which people came to and hung out. Hung out, not asking questions, hung out with him, because being in his presence induced a kind of a sacred feeling that they all began to feel. And people would come to him and hang out with him and ask him questions. And even before they would say a word, he would tell them who and what they were. He would mention details of their life that they had before coming to India. These are people from Portugal, from Spain, from Africa, from the United States. He would see their lives. And the people would go, wow, that's amazing. You're a real mind reader, aren't you? No, he's not a mind reader. Unless you want to say reading your own mind is mind reading. Because he was reading his own mind. Because his own mind was the mind that occupied all of them at the same time. He was tuning to the one mind, the Krishna mind, not the Arjuna mind. And that's the secret of time travel. That's what the yoga of time travel is all about. And that's how you can defeat time. See you next time when we bring this all to a conclusion.
This concludes Session 11. Our program continues with Session 12, The Technology of God, with Fred Allen Wolf.
Well, we're at the final session, Session 12. and I've entitled this The Technology of God. What could I mean by that? Well, you know, as a kid, I've always wondered, how did God do it? How did this whole thing we call the universe come into being? What is the way in which God uses, manipulates, makes, creates? How did it all happen? What is the technology used? And now we use the term technology to mean almost different things. In our normal everyday world, we think of technology in terms of machinery, the things we manufacture, the factories that produce the cars and the TVs and the radios and even the meat and the salads and the milk and the cartons. And all that involves some kind of thing we call technology. But also technology can involve something that is practiced that doesn't involve any actual mechanical gears and wheels turning to be called a technology. When I was with shamans, particularly Australian Aboriginal shamans, I noticed that they had a kind of a technology. For example, we were sitting on a porch one night and a bird, I mean it, a bird, a white crow flew by and landed on the porch, walked across the porch and flew away. And I looked at the old fella, shaman, Aboriginal guy, sitting with me, and he paid very close attention to what that white crow was doing, and then got up and started talking to other people that I didn't hear what he said. Later on, I asked, what was going on? He says, he's got to leave. He just found out that his cousin in the village, which is about, 500 miles from here, just had a heart attack. And I went, what? What? And then I found out, crows are the communication technology in this particular tribal situation. Anyway, technology can mean lots of different things. So I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about this notion of the technology of God. And in a way, this is going to be the summary, the drawing together, the concluding ideas, which really we've been talking about in this adventure into a user's guide into the universe. Into your universe. Well, let me just look over what we've been, and then we'll get into this technology stuff. I told you in the first session something about quantum physics, and I also gave you some inkling as to why you should care about this, how quantum physics gives us a new way of seeing into the universe, and how, as a result, it opens up the door to the possibility of other possibilities that you may not have ever thought of. It gives you new metaphors. It gives you possibly scientific ways of dealing with the world. It also gives you new technologies, which is appropriate. So that's really what the first session was all about. In the second session, we began to look at the question as, is there really an out there? Is there really anything there? I mean, what is out there? And we began looking at the notion of the quantum leap, the jump from what is to what could be without going in between, and how quantum physics gives us a story of everything being possible until something becomes actual, and that act of changing possibility into actuality, that quantum jump in which things come into a focus, that whole thing is what's called a quantum leap, and that is the action by which out there gets created. So that's what we talked about in session two. In the third session, we talked about what consciousness does, the mind in the body, how quantum physics has really changed the way we think about our whole experience, and how the movement of matter is very much influenced by the movement of mind. And including, of course, the mind, which is in your body. And in the fourth session, we talked about another idea, which is called parallel universes, how quantum physics indicates that there are parallel realities that come into being whenever an observation comes into being. And we talked about even what consciousness does when it's confronted with alternate possibilities. In the fifth session, we went into a little bit of detail on time bends and space warps. I tried to tell you a little bit about how physics has opened up the door to us seeing that time is not absolutely linear and fixed, and that space is not just out there and unyielding, but that space can be bent and time can be bent or warped, and that these kinds of things were very necessary for us to understand relativity, the relativistic ideas which led into this new vision of space, time, and matter. In the sixth session, we went from the physics into the shamanic world, and I told you about sex and magic and what the shamanic world was all about and how shamans utilize some of these sex and magic ways of thinking and ways of experiencing to change the reality that you call yourself. In the seventh session, we talked about dreams. It was called Where the Psyche and Physics Meet, and how dreams may be the cornerstone or the basis upon which actual realities come into being. If you dream it, it can become real. Not if you dream it, it's a fantasy or an hallucination, but possibly the building block upon which all of reality, and particularly the reality you call you, yourself, comes into being. So we talked about how dreams create a self. And in the eighth session, we talked about how all of this makes a spiritual universe a reality for us to think about. How spirit is part of the universe. How the universe couldn't even have begun without spirit present in its essence. And how that spirit is part of this invisible realm, this realm which we believe exists beyond space, time, and matter, this realm out of which even the universe itself came into being. And we talked a little bit about how the notion of self arises and how soul has a relationship with self. All that was part of the spiritual universe. In the ninth session, we talked about what I call the beginnings of a new alchemy. What are the alchemical steps that change mind into matter? And I pointed out there were basically nine steps as you transform from the void into the first cellular structure. How you go from the Aleph until you get to the Tate. Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, He, Vav, and then from Vav we go to Zain, and then to Chet, and then to Tate. And how those nine letters represent symbolically what happens as spirit gets transformed into matter. And then in the 10th session, we talked about matter into feeling and how these very basic elements, these nine elements, can appear in the physical universe as not the numbers 1 through 9, but the numbers 10 through 90. Remember, every one of these elements is a number as well as a letter. And we talked about then how matter into feeling takes place and how the living presence, the living sense of who and what you are actually comes into being. And we even gave you some examples of how this transformation, this alchemical transformation takes place and how you can, once you understand what's going on, how you can use it to transform any situation you find yourself in. Because there's a deep secret to all this that has to do with this thing we call the I, this presence we call the I-ness, your highness. And in the 11th session, I talked about how you can time travel through the whole universe. Once you understand that time travel and your ego or your I, yourself, or who you think you are really connected together. And I told you the story of Krishna and Arjuna and how Arjuna, who is very much confined in time, is taken out of time by Krishna, who then allows him to see that by getting out of time, he can travel in time throughout the whole universe. So that basically is what's led us now to the final session, which is the technology of God. Now, when spirit enters into a universe, how do we know it's happened? Well, we know that it happens because it enters into individuals, into selves, into beings, into people. If it didn't, we wouldn't have any spiritual sense of who and what we are. Some of us have forgotten that. Some of us have mistaken intellectual understanding for a spiritual feeling of what life is all about. And that is to your detriment. You don't want to replace your intellectual understanding by spiritual feeling, and you certainly don't want to replace your spiritual feeling by intellectual understanding. You want both. You want to have a very keen intellectual understanding, and you want to have the ability to spiritually feel your way into this universe. You need to recognize something about yourself which you really find a hard time telling yourself, that in really, you are the God presence yourself. You are Krishna yourself. And I know that sounds maybe blasphemous to people who claim that they're religiously enlightened. And I want to tell you something, it ain't blasphemous at all. It's really our very nature. Now, to call yourself God seems kind of, I don't want to do that. I don't blame you. I wouldn't want to call myself God either because it seems too highfalutin. I don't like calling myself Lord or King or President or Doctor or any kind of title which makes me feel, you know, more highfalutin than I think I am, because I like to play the part of just being little old me, just ordinary me, doing my ordinary boring things in life. I'd rather be that, and I'd rather just know that God is up there taking care of me if I pray to him. And you don't have to do that. You yourself are the God presence acting out who and what you think you are. Sounds like blasphemy? No, it's not blasphemy. It's spiritual realization. It's a realization that comes to you in such a way that whatever religion you practice, whatever spiritual belief you might have, you'll see that they are all just different ways of approaching the same subject. There is something very spiritual about you as you are. I don't care what you believe. I don't care what religion you follow. I don't care how you think. I don't care whether you're smart. I don't care whether you're stupid. I don't care whether you're ugly, whether you're beautiful. I don't care whether you're a man or a woman or a child. I don't care if you're 80 or if you're 8. It makes no difference to me. You are the presence of God. And when I look at you, that's what I see. I see the presence of God. I don't see just a little tiny guy walking around. I see God playing a role. And for me, that's funny. I think it's funny to think about the fact that everything is this action of this God presence playing these funny roles. And because I know that I'm going to continue as God forever, and so are you because you are me, then it doesn't bother me. I just go through life with that kind of, maybe you would say, illusion. But if it is only illusion, I think it's the right illusion to have. Because whatever you think is real, I want to tell you something, it's also an illusion too. So realizing the technology of God is first realizing the illusorial character of the physical world itself. And I hope that by listening, maybe listening again to some of these sessions that I've just provided for you, you're going to be able to see that truth for yourself. Not as being the truth, the absolute, no. But as something which you can put into practice for yourself. Now, people have asked me, Dr. Wolf, can you tell me what I need to do in order to do this or to have that or realize this? And I say no. I say no to you. I'm not going to tell you what to do, because telling you what to do gets you into the doing and not into the living and the experiencing of what's going on. You got to experience this, not that you have to, it's that you will, once you begin to understand that you can let go of any preconceived ideas you have. And if you can't let go of any preconceived ideas that you have right now, pretend that you can let go of any preconceived ideas that you have right now. And if you just do that, you begin to get a different vision. Also, listen to these sessions, because they contain insights that I think will help you gain access to this technology, to this way of actually being in the world. It's a way, a technology which is non-technical. It's a way, it's a technology which allows you, if anything, to let go of any technical, standard, operational practices that you must do. In other words, like an apple a day keeps a doctor away. Do 5 asanas in the morning and 6 in the afternoon and you'll become a yogi. Stand on your head for 15 minutes and you'll learn all the wisdom of the universe. Read this book and you will understand everything. I don't believe in any of that. I believe that you should certainly read, you could certainly listen, you should certainly do yoga asanas, you should certainly do whatever you want to do, but always do it with the understanding that you are more than whatever you think you are doing that. Now, some of you might be listening to this and start to think, whoa, this is powerful stuff. What if little old me starts to really do some of this stuff? What's going to happen to me? Well, I'm going to begin by telling a story of one physicist who actually began to have these kinds of realizations, and as a result, began to understand himself in a very different light. His name was Wolfgang Pauli. Now, Wolfgang Pauli was a very interesting guy. For those of you who don't recognize the name, he was the discoverer of a very famous principle of quantum physics called the Pauli exclusion principle. What it said was no two particles could ever be in the same state at the same time. It was the principle of exclusivity. Without exclusivity, nothing separate could arise. He saw how quantum physics, through this principle of exclusivity, allowed for the exclusivity needed for electrons in an atom so that one atom would be different from another atom, so that different atoms could combine to form molecules, chemistry, basically all the building blocks of life. We wouldn't have understood a thing about that if it hadn't been for Wolfgang Pauli's principle of exclusivity, principle of exclusion. Very famous. He got the Nobel Prize for this. But Pauli was a kind of a paradoxical guy. Now, even though he got the Nobel Prize, and even though he was a brilliant guy, there was something a little bit off about him. He was disturbed. He had bad dreams. He was psychologically depressed a lot of the time. Later, he actually began to work with the psychologist Carl Jung and became deeply interested in the psychological aspects of his view of nature. And because of that, he began to realize that all physical research, all the ideas about what to look for, when to look for, how we set up machinery and all that sort of stuff, all that is the result of psychic actions within the brains of the experimenters and theoreticians who make up these ideas. So he began to realize that the unconscious, in Jungian Freudian terms, was far more important in the creation of theories of the universe than had ever been thought before. In other words, Jung wanted to understand the technology of God. That's what he was into. So becoming convinced that the unconscious was important, he thought, why not start with his own unconscious? So that's why he approached Carl Jung and began a study of himself through the auspices of Jungian psychology. Now, Pauli believed that all of reality, the universe, everything in it, had two aspects to it. A rational self, which seems to surface as objective reality, and something that was irrational or possibly irrational aspect. Now, scientists generally don't like irrational or irrational. It's kind of disturbing because everything should be out in the open. We like to see things we can feel with our senses. But Pauli was indicating there is no reality out there unless it's perceived. And it's the act of perception, this underlying, almost irrational, irrational reality that really got Pauli interested. He was convinced, Pauli was, that the rational was incomplete and not the whole story. Philosophers of the time, for example, Wittgenstein, believed that if one even attempts to even speak about a one world containing both matter and spirit, rationality and irrationality, the attempts to speak about such a world results in absolute silence and the closing of all doors. I may paraphrase and say, the slamming of all doors closed. It's like, we don't want to know that stuff. We don't want to talk about that stuff. Pauli's irrationalities came to light in a very interesting way. They came to light in his dreams. So let me tell you a little bit about some of his dreams, because I think they're very interesting, and they tell us a lot about what we may be facing, I hope, not as maybe badly as some of Pauly's, but it gives us some idea as to where the fear of the irrationality and the fear of understanding what God is talking about and what God is about and the technology of God and the admittance to oneself that one is God in disguise, how that fear may arise, because it's that fear which holds us back. It's that fear which separates us. It's that fear which makes us feel that my way is right and your way is wrong. It's that fear which, in a sense, creates the exclusivity universe of separation that we all believe is the actual universe. But what I'm telling you, and if you understand this, we'll see that's just an illusion. So let's look at this, because I think it's important to understand a guy, a brave man, Wolfgang Pauly, who really attempted to get through that fear. What was he like? Well, first, let me tell you that he died in 1958, a very young man. He died of I don't know what disease. It might have been cancer, but I'm not sure. He was only in his 50s when he died. And there seems to be a lot of mystery surrounding his life as well as his death. Many people that knew him said he was one of the most difficult people you could know. He was unpleasant a lot of the time and very critical of other physicists' work or their apparent slow-wittedness. He was a very sharp guy. When somebody would present an idea to him that he thought was stupid, quote-unquote, I mean, this was the way he was. He was the epitome of the hubris of a scientist, the epitome of arrogance that you often associate with physicists or scientists or intellectuals in general. He was the epitome of that. Somebody would present an idea to him and he would say, that idea isn't even wrong. I mean, it was so bad, it isn't even wrong. That's how he'd put other scientists down who were slow-witted or whatever. He had a very quick mind, a very sharp tongue, and rumors about him persisted. It was said about him that whenever Wolfgang Pauly was visiting a town where an experiment was going on, the experiment would fail the instant Pauly arrived in town and the laboratory would close down. This had occurred so many times, according to experimenters, that they called this the Pauly effect. And if on a given day, when an experiment was being carried out, if it were to suddenly fail, they would stop and ask, was Pauly visiting their town today? In other words, anytime an experiment failed, it must be because Pauly's here. So it's not surprising. I mean, there's this brilliant mind who has a kind of a shamanic influence on all of reality. And here's this guy now with bravery attempting to find out this underlying irrational side to his own nature, which he's going to find out through dreams. This was his alchemical investigation into the nature of reality. Now, a Finnish physicist whose name is Laurikainen provided a series of studies about his alchemical views and wrote a series of books about them. Pauly actually wrote a series of letters in these books where he was corresponding with a friend of his and a former research assistant whose name is Marcus Fiers. Now, Fiers had been Pauly's assistant at the Polytechnic Institute in Zurich, Switzerland, and was then a professor of theoretical physics at the University of Basel in Switzerland. Well, Pauly had written that he felt conflicted. He had written, along with Carl Jung, a book about Robert Fludd and Johannes Kepler. Johannes Kepler was the astronomer. Remember, I told you about him before, the Astronomer Royal in Germany. And Robert Fludd was a physician. And the two were very much opposites. Kepler had become the kind of the epitome of the scientist, and Fludd was the epitome of the alchemist. So in opposition to Kepler's quantitative view of the universe, Fludd had seen it in an alchemical, mystical way. Pauly wrote to Fiers one day, he says, I myself am not only Kepler, but I am also Fludd. In me, both these antagonists rage and battle. I sense in me that my unconscious is trying to reconcile the seemingly unreconcilable viewpoints of alchemy and physics by producing images to me which come out in my dreams. And he wrote in the same letter that in my search for the process of unifying these two aspects of me, I've only made a partial success. Nevertheless, my first partial success involved a dream. Now, can you guys out there guess what this dream was of? Let me give you a hint. A dream of an exotic woman. He found Chinese women with their slanted eyes very, very exotic. He called them slit-eyed Chinese. And these women would appear in his dream. And later on in that same dream, or in other dreams that he was to have, another character would appear. A man who he labeled as the light-dark man. Because sometimes he'd be light in color of skin, and sometimes dark in color of skin. And this light-dark man, after all, light and dark are opposites, was the merger of the opposites that he himself was struggling with. I mean, you gotta admire this. I mean, what could be more simple than the merging of opposites than to have a guy who's got light skin and dark skin in his dream? Pretty convincing symbol, I would say. Anyway, when Paulie, in one of his dreams, during a time of severe depression, just after he returned to Switzerland after a short stay in the United States, just after the World War II had ended, he had become very depressed, and he lost all of his craving, his zest, his desire to keep doing modern physics. And during the severe depression, he then dreamed of a character that he called the Persian, which he then recognized that this Persian was nothing more than his previously dreamt light-dark man. And first, Paulie tells us this story about this Persian. He says, I come to my former home, and I see this dark-skinned young man whom I recognize is the Persian, and he's putting objects into the house, into my house, through the window. I wonder, why is he doing that? I make out a circular piece of wood and several letters. That's interesting, too, because the letters are, remember, symbolic of Aleph, Beit, Gimel, remember all that. Wood and letters. Then he approaches me in a friendly manner, and I start to talk to him. I say to him, what's going on? You're not allowed to go in the house? You're not allowed to study? For me, going into the house and studying were the same. And the Persian says, no. Therefore, I only study in secret. And Paul says, well, what are you studying? And the Persian says, you. I'm studying you. And Paul says, you are speaking to me in a very sharp voice, and I'm not happy about that. And the Persian says, I speak as someone to whom everything else has been forbidden. I speak as someone to whom everything else has been forbidden. In other words, here's this light-dark man, this Persian, this character, who has been pushed down into the murky depths of Paulie's unconscious and not allowed to surface. And Paulie then says to him, oh, having learned some Jungian psychology, he says, are you my shadow? And the Persian says, I am between you and the light, so you are my shadow, not the reverse. Now, Paulie is really thrown by this, because the dream is telling him that his whole objective reality is merely a shadow of a deeper, more mystical, more spiritual reality. The light dark man is beginning to share with him the technology of God, and Paulie is still, you know, hesitant about this. This is kind of frightening. So Paulie finally says, well, do you study physics at least? You know, do you understand physics? I mean, you know, do you or do you not? And the light dark man, the Persian, says, there, your language of physics is too difficult for me. But I want to tell you something else. In my language, you don't understand physics at all. Now, Paulie is really shook up by this. He's the smartest physicist alive. You know, he's really witty. He puts down others. He's being put down by the light dark man who tells him, you don't even understand physics. So this is giving Paulie a hint that there's a deeper reality a subjective physics reality that Paulie needs to come in contact with. And when he does, if he's willing to, it's going to take a brave step to do so, he may find out that everything he believes to be real is not the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Well, Paulie's dreams are very important for us. So let me tell you now what they are signifying. There are more dreams, which I can tell you about, but let me tell you what the bottom line is. Where are we going with this? The bottom line that this light dark man is trying to tell Paulie is that what Paulie thinks is real is Maya, illusion. And even more, particularly for Paulie, who came up with the exclusion principle, even that is an illusion. And the epitome of that illusion is the notion that not only are there not separate particles and being in separate states, which is really, you know, the basis of all chemistry, but the notion of separation is something that needs to be reconsidered, particularly in our quantum physical view, in which we begin to understand that what quantum physics is telling us is non-separability, non-locality, that everything is one. We finally come to the ultimate understanding of the technology of God, which is multiple minds. How can it be that we each believe that we have separate minds when in fact there's only one mind present? Well, let me tell you a little story about this, and this will tie this all together. In an ancient philosophical problem that may sound a little silly to you when I tell you this, but let me go on with it anyway. It goes something like this. You are in a room and you're looking out of the window at a garden. Now, according to quantum physics, when you observe something like the garden, you bring it into being. It comes there. It's there, and you saw it, and you brought it into focus, and you had a picture of it, and not only did it happen in your mind, it happened out there in the garden. Now, you decide to get up and leave. You go out of the room. You go into the second room, a room next door, which has blinds or a shield or a curtain, and you close the curtain. And the room becomes completely black. And you're standing in a completely black room. You certainly cannot see the garden anymore. Now, according to quantum physics, what you don't observe starts to bloom out. It starts to go into the land of the doodle land. Doo-doo-doo-doo. It becomes uncertain. It becomes possibilities. It no longer is just one thing. So what happens to the garden as a result? Well, as I said, if you are the only mind that is present, that ever was, ever is, ever will be, then that garden has got to become multiple garden possibilities the minute you enter it into the darkened room. Now, that's hard for most of us to grasp. We don't even believe it. We know that the garden's still there, at least we think we do. And, you know, if I'm not there, is the moon still up in the sky? If I'm not looking, we all believe it is. Is there a moon when nobody's looking at it? We all believe there is. So what's going on here? How can the moon just bulge out into multiple moons? Well, suppose that there is another person still looking and who sees the single garden while you're in the dark room seeing nothing. What is that telling you? Well, from a common sense viewpoint, one person is seeing light and the other, you, is seeing darkness. No problem, common sense tells you, since two people with separate minds exist. But from your darkened perspective, from your understanding of quantum physics, and your understanding of what happens when you're not observing anything, according to you, that person, since you're not observing him either, and those garden, that garden out there, should all bloom out into multiple possibilities because you're not there to see them. Hence, we're in a paradoxical situation. From your point of view, the world you don't see, including the person in the lighted room, are multiple people, multiple realities. But from the other person's point of view, nothing like that occurs. He sees the garden, a single garden, and certainly a single self. Well, we can't have it both ways. It is a paradox. It's a reductio ad absurdum. It can't be both ways. You can't have it both ways. Either there are multiple gardens or they're not. If not, which common sense tells us they're not, then quantum physics must be wrong. It's just got to be wrong. And if it is wrong, then since from your point of view, no observation has taken place, it's got to be incorrect. But if quantum physics is right, then there have to be multiple gardens. So the person in the lighted room must also be multiple people. And since you're not looking at him, yet if you asked him what he sees and what he believes, he'd tell you that he's perfectly normal and perfectly phrenic, as opposed to schizophrenic, and as sane as anybody else you ever would meet. And so the paradox is, how can the world be this way? How can it be following one set of rules according to you and another set of rules according to somebody else or another understanding of the world? This paradox, this way of having this paradox, will always arise so long as minds can be thought of as compartmentalized in bodies. If a mind can exist separate from yours, then you are allowed to consider in operation in such a way that it must follow quantum rules separate from you. Hence, the other mind that you don't have any privy to must be a schizophrenic mind of multiple realities. The only way to resolve the paradox is to get rid of the notion of separate minds. That's the only solution to the puzzle. Once you realize that there's only one mind capable of seeing both light and dark simultaneously, then the paradox is gone. Once that one mind acts and changes the multiple gardens into a single landscape, it's done so for all the minds, or for the mind in separate places, if you will. That still leaves this problem. How can one consciousness exist in what seems to be two or more places and only be one mind? Even though that mind seems to be in two places, it really is not. Whatever is conscious in the world cannot just be between your ears, his ears, her ears, or the ears of anyone else, but they have to exist completely non-locally. The mind is everywhere at once. It's nowhere at once. It doesn't have anything like location. So that is how the one mind acts. Well, if that's how it acts, why do I get the impression that there's two people or a billion people or 6 billion people on our planet? Where does that all come from? Well, if you take it as the fact that there's only one mind, then it must be that all these separate people that you see are illusions, that it's all a motion picture, a hologram, a dream of a great spirit, a technology of God. All of this is part of the way that that one mind operates. And once we realize that, we can begin to tune more to the one mind than to the separate realities. And when we begin to do that, then the universe begins to open. And so I hope by now that you can use this user's guide to your universe to find your way through it. Because after all, you are that universe.
This concludes Dr. Quantum Presents, A User's Guide to Your Universe with Fred Allen Wolf. Music by Nawang Ketchog from the album Universal Love, available through Sounds True. For more information on Fred Allen Wolf, please visit www.fredallenwolf.com. If you would like additional copies of this audio learning series, or to receive a complete catalog of wisdom teachings for the inner life, please call Sounds True, 800-333-9185, or visit us on the World Wide Web at www.soundstrue.com, or write the Sounds True Catalog, P.O. Box 8010, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. Thank you for listening.